Gun Control Supporters Rally in Helena. Good evening, I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Jovetic, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also have an update on the Westmoreland fire burning near Superior. And in our feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talks with University of Montana astrophysicist Nate McGrady about the search for life on other planets. Control supporters on a 25-state bus tour are urging Senator Max Baucus to change his mind regarding background check legislation stalled in the U.S. Senate. The group held a rally on the front steps of the Capitol today. Reporter Dan Boyce says Montana's senior senator does not seem swayed.
John McMahon, age 66, killed with a gun on December 24, 2012, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
The No More Names tour is driving around the country over the course of 100 days to urge passage of stricter gun control laws. The group begins their Helena rally by listing names of some of the thousands killed by guns in the last year.
Jaleesa Scott, age 22, killed with a gun.
The organization Mayors Against Illegal Guns is sponsoring the tour. That group has been around since 2006, but they're stepping up their efforts in the wake of recent mass shootings at a school in Newtown, Connecticut, and at a movie theater in Aurora, Colorado. Montana president of the National Organization for Women, Marion Bradley, lived in Aurora for years.
I never want to have the horror of a mass shooting happen here in Montana. It changes the complexion of communities so dramatically.
Bradley says the Newtown shootings woke the nation up to the need for greater gun control. And the other speakers at the rally focus on universal background checks.
Today is both a memorial to those persons lost to gun violence, and it's also a call to action.
Like former deputy chief of the Santa Rosa, California Police Department, Scott Swanson. He retired to Montana more than a year ago. He says the International Association of Chiefs of Police strongly endorses background checks.
What's the reason? It's because they work. It's a crime prevention measure that works, and it's very easily done. It doesn't cost a lot of money, it doesn't take much time, and it doesn't interfere with anyone's personal rights.
Swanson says the rally sends a message to Senator Max Baucus, who voted against recent universal background check legislation.
Senator Baucus, you owe it to us to change your vote.
Senator Baucus was not available for comment, but his office released a statement saying the senator did vote to increase funding for mental health care and school safety. The statement says what works in New York or California won't necessarily work in Montana. Quote, Max voted to boost gun prosecution in inner cities and high crime areas without adding burdens on law-abiding folks in Montana. End quote. The background check bill Baucus voted against was about a half dozen votes shy of preventing a filibuster, which halted it. Senator John Tester did vote for the bill. Former Deputy Police Chief Scott Swanson urges Senator Baucus to change his mind, if not for this bill coming back up, then for one from Baucus himself.
He's crafted all kinds of legislation during the course of his honorable career. But to now say, well, there's no legislation out there, then I say to him as an incredibly responsible senator, craft the legislation yourself and carry it forward.
The public outcry for new gun control legislation was strong following the Newtown shooting. That sense of urgency may be dissipating among the American public as new issues such as immigration reshift attention. A couple dozen people attended the No More Names rally in Helena. They're holding another one in Missoula on Thursday. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
And in other news from around the state, firefighters continue to make steady progress on the 6,300-acre Westmoreland fire burning near Superior. That fire is now 60% contained. Information Officer John Hamilton says cooler night temperatures are helping.
The burnout operations have done well. The night shifts really helped us out on this fire, too, because we were able to take advantage of the cooler weather and get some good work done at night.
Meanwhile, the 6-acre fire that broke out yesterday north of Stimson Mill near Bonner is 100% contained. Fire officials remind everyone that fire danger is still very high and Stage 1 restrictions go into effect August 1st.
The flash flood damage to Bannack State Park will keep the southwestern Montana ghost town closed to tourists for at least a month, but cleanup work has already begun. Lieutenant Governor John Walsh and the state parks administrator toured the site yesterday to survey damage caused by the July 17th flooding. About 80% of the town's buildings were damaged, and the assay office was destroyed, and boardwalks were torn out. Walsh noted that some of the steel mining equipment was moved by the 3-foot surge of water that pushed through town. State park officials don't have an estimated cost of the damage, but the park is insured. Park manager Dale Carlson says more cleanup is needed before engineers can examine foundations. Bannack was established in 1862 and was Montana's first territorial capital.
A woman from Montana's Crow Reservation plans to plead guilty to killing her 3-year-old daughter by throwing her from a moving pickup truck. Court documents filed yesterday say Mary Agnes Leiter of St. Xavier will change her plea without a deal to lessen the second-degree murder charge for the December 3rd death of Tennille Big Day. U.S. District Judge Donald Molloy has set a change of plea hearing in Billings tomorrow. Prosecutors say Tennille was on Leiter's lap in a pickup driven by Leiter's brother after a night of drinking. Leiter's brother told an FBI investigator his sister opened the passenger door and threw Tennille onto U.S. Highway 313. The girl died of blunt force trauma to the head. Leiter originally told authorities she struck her head and could not remember what happened.
A 19-year-old man charged with killing his great-grandmother in Billings told investigators he got angry when she said he was going to turn out just like his father. Robert Allen Thompson was arrested Saturday in Denver, a day after the body of 77-year-old Shirley Lawrence was found in her house. The Billings Gazette reports charging documents filed yesterday indicate Thompson told Denver police that he was talking with Lawrence about concerns over finding a job when she told him, quote, he was going to be just like his father, unquote. Court records say Thompson told investigators that he got angry, struck Lawrence in the back of the head with a metal object, and then stabbed her in the chest. Thompson remains jailed in Denver pending extradition to Montana.
A 55-year-old Billings woman who struck a plea agreement that dismissed what would have been her 13th DUI was given a 3-year suspended sentence and warned by the judge that if she drives drunk and kills someone, she, quote, will spend some real time in prison, unquote. The Billings Gazette reports Lori Ann Cole was sentenced yesterday by District Judge G. Todd Baugh for felony criminal endangerment and driving without an interlock device. Cole was charged in September 2011 after a motorist reported seeing a female driver weaving all over the road. While Cole performed poorly on a field sobriety test, her blood alcohol level was below the legal limit of 0.08%. She also was taking prescription medications. Defense attorney Jeff Michael says the prosecution had problems with its case and the agreement was beneficial to both sides.
The 3 people injured by a lightning strike in Glacier National Park last week were released from the hospital over the weekend, and Atlanta Junior High teacher Stephen Keith was happy to hear it. Keith was among the first people to come upon Travis Heitman of Kalispell, Kenzie Leishman of Missoula, and 11-year-old boy named Noah after they were knocked out by lightning that struck near them on July 17th. Keith tells a Missoulian a woman named Beth started CPR in Heitman, and he was amazed that his CPR training came back to him as he worked to revive Leishman. He says Beth spotted the boy lying unconscious several feet off the trail. He says it took longer to revive the boy. All 3 were treated at the hospital in Kalispell.
47 million Americans currently receive Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, benefits. The USDA Undersecretary for Food, Nutrition, and Consumer Services, Kevin Concannon, says that's the highest number of recipients in the history of the program.
About 45% of that number are children up to age 18. Another 8 to 10% are seniors. Another similar percentage are people with long-term disabilities. But the context in which I look at that number is we now in the U.S. have the highest raw number, actual number of people under the federal poverty level in the history of the country. There are nearly 50 million Americans whose net income annually does not bring them up to the federal poverty level.
We'll have more with Kevin Concannon on tomorrow's Montana Evening Edition.
Glacier National Park rangers captured and euthanized a black bear that had been frequenting a campground, foraging for food and charging visitors. Park officials said today that the 3-year-old female black bear had been hanging around the Fish Creek campground near Lake McDonald in the western part of the park for 2 weeks. Efforts to haze the bear away were unsuccessful. Park rangers set up traps near the campground, captured the bear on Sunday, and euthanized it. Park visitors are reminded to keep campgrounds and developed areas clean and free of food and traps. trash that might attract bears. Regulations require that all food containers and cookware be stored in a hard-sided vehicle or food locker when not in use, and that trash be placed in bear-proof containers.
NASA recently awarded a $1 million grant to researchers at the University of Montana to explore, among other things, whether there is life on other planets. UM will join with three other universities around the country to take part in Project Minerva, which will use an array of four telescopes to research so-called exoplanets. UM Associate Professor of Astrophysics Nate McCready will lead the effort in Missoula. In tonight's feature interview, McCready talks with News Director Sally Mock about the study of exoplanets, which he explains are planets that orbit stars other than the Sun.
So we're aware of eight planets that orbit our own star, the Sun. So if you think about a planet orbiting another star, a pretty simple concept to think of, we call that an exoplanet if it's a different star.
Those planets are being studied because...
Well, it's fascinating. They're fascinating in their own right because you have one example of a planetary system when you study this our own solar system. So our Sun is a sort of garden variety star. It's a sort of a mid-sized star. It's a middle-aged star. And it has one set of eight planets, and we live on one of them. But it's, I think, a pretty interesting question in its own right to just ask, are there planets around other stars? And there was every reason to believe that there would be, but until about 12 years ago, we had no evidence of that. And now we're aware of hundreds of planets around hundreds of other stars.
We also want to study these, don't we, because it's possible that they have life.
You know, this is one of the big questions that mankind has wondered for centuries, is are we the sole example of life or sentient life, even more so, in the universe? And one of the first steps in trying to answer that sort of long-standing question of our place in the universe is looking for other planets, other places in the universe that would be suitable to sustain life, the types of planets that might have, say, liquid water on their surface or an atmosphere or both. The things that we see as being important for hosting life on Earth or in the solar system, we can look for those conditions around other stars as well.
And this is any kind of life, right? We're not necessarily talking about intelligent life, but life, period.
Sure. It's putting the cart ahead of the horse a little bit to try and identify what types of life might be on these other planets. That's still in the realm of speculation at this point. But where our science and astrophysics has reached at this point is being able to identify what the surfaces would be. Where would you put the life? And so we try to identify those exoplanets. They're at the right distances from their star to have conditions suitable for what we would expect life to require.
The money that UM just received, the NASA grant, is part of what's called Project Minerva. And this is, I understand, four institutions, including UM, are part of this project. And that project is to look for these planets and look for these signs of life.
Absolutely. So Project Minerva is a collaboration among four universities, the University of Montana, Harvard University, Penn State University, and Caltech. And these institutions have come together to build Minerva, an array of telescopes where we'll use four small telescopes, connect them to one set of instrumentation, and dedicate that observatory full-time to looking for Earth-like planets around nearby stars.
How did UM get with three very prestigious institutions to be part of this?
Yeah, you know, this. People ask me oftentimes about this as Minerva has gotten going in the last year or so. Why UM? How did we get involved? And the fact of the matter is the internet age has made astronomy a sort of multi-institution global affair. Really, the science has gone where the scientists are. So, you know, we have the ability to work remotely. We control our telescopes remotely over the internet. We, on the team, work through video conferences, telephone calls, email. So it's not really important where the scientists are. So the science goes where the scientists are. And I happen to be here teaching at the University of Montana, which I really love. And, you know, my collaboration with my colleagues on the Minerva team just happens to have us where we are.
I was reading about the kind of telescopes that are being used for this research, and one fact I read was that space-based telescopes are actually better than ground-based.
Yes, it depends on what you're trying to do. So we have telescopes at various different locations around the Earth. I mean, there are telescopes that are in polar locations, there are telescopes on mountaintops, and there are telescopes in orbit. And each one of those different locations where you put a telescope has different advantages and disadvantages. Space has the advantage that you can not have to worry about the atmosphere muddling up your view. You don't have to worry about interference from radio stations, no offense, or
none taken.
cellular telephones and things like this. But space is also extremely expensive. It's very hard to get there. It's very expensive to do the rocket launches. It's almost impossible to repair and maintain a telescope. Hubble was the great exception of any telescope that's ever been put up and then repaired or modified. Instruments go obsolete, and it's very hard to replace them if you're 1.5 million miles from the Earth, like the Kepler satellite is. So there are some advantages to being in space, but there's some major disadvantages. And so we can build larger telescopes that we can maintain, that we can keep current instrumentation on, that you can drive up to here on the surface of the Earth, that have big advantages. And if the atmosphere is not a major, if the motion of the Earth's atmosphere is not a major impediment to your science, then there's no reason not to do it from the ground. And that's where we are in this project with Minerva. We're looking at nearby stars, so they tend to be relatively bright. And we don't really have to worry about atmospheric distortions and things because the stars are so bright.
Besides the curiosity factor, why should we care?
I mean, to me, as an astrophysicist, the question is sort of self-evident. I mean, don't we want to know? If your listeners have ever seen the movie Contact,
Jodie Foster.
With Jodie Foster, Carl Sagan wrote it. You know, one of the things for me watching that film 10, 12 years ago when it came out, your first instinct as an astrophysicist is to see, did they get the science right?
Did they?
They did, by the way. Carl Sagan wrote the book, so it had pretty good odds. So the science was pretty well done in that movie, but the point at which they fictionally came in contact with another life, another civilization, other life forms, communicating with them across the vast reaches of space. One thing I hadn't anticipated and thought was fascinating about the movie is the cultural effects that would have, the way people reacted and the scenes that they had in the movie, fictionalized as it was, of people camping out in the desert wanting to know. And I think there's a very human appeal to wanting to know what our place in the universe is. Where did we come from? Are we alone? Are we the only life forms out there? Is this lucky? And for some people, there's a major theological aspects to this question. I think for anyone, there's philosophical questions that come up with this. But just anybody can walk out and look up at the night sky and you see thousands of bright points of light just with your eye out in your backyard in Missoula, and looking up and thinking, is there anyone looking back?
Are we prepared if there is? You bring up the cultural impact, and Contact, that movie, raised that too, because that would be a radical change in our outlook of our place in the universe. And it seems to me the ramifications of that are many.
Yeah, I mean, that's really, I think, more a question for a sociologist or a political scientist, so I'll hide behind my PhD a little bit on that one. But from a scientific standpoint, we're reaching the point where we can start identifying where those planets might be. There are many things to say, are we alone, to answer that question and to find another civilization and make first contact or something like that, like you saw in the movie Contact or other movies in the science fiction genre. But there's a lot of steps along the way. And this isn't the first step that we're doing with Minerva, but it's one of the early steps. When I was an undergrad 15 years ago, we didn't know for sure that there were other Earth-like planets around. And now, based on scientific data from measurements, we know that these planets are in abundance, that our galaxy probably has more small rocky planets than it has stars. And there's 200 billion stars in our galaxy. So this is a young but rapidly growing science. And to jump to the question of, are we prepared as a society? Well, I don't think there's a lot of worry that we're going to find another civilization asking us over for dinner in the next 10 years. But what we can find is the places where we should look very carefully to see if we do find life. And it's worth mentioning also that, the Earth has only had the ability to communicate. Deer and porcupines can't contact other civilizations at this point on other planets. Humans have the ability to do that now, but we've only had that ability for 100 years. And so out of the several million year history of life on Earth, things walking around out of the ocean, 100 years is a very, very small fraction of that time.
What are the odds, do you think?
What are the odds? You know, that's an interesting question. If you want to talk about speculation, then you can start dealing with really large numbers in astronomy. As I mentioned, there's 200 billion stars or so in our galaxy alone, let alone the 100 billion other galaxies. But if we stick to our galaxy, 200 billion stars, we know factually from measurements now that there are more planets than stars. On average, each star has more than one planet. So you've got a couple hundred, 300 billion maybe planets to work with, and some of those are going to be rocky. In fact, more of them are rocky than big gassy things like Jupiter. And some of those are going to be close enough to their star to have liquid water. So you start narrowing it down and multiplying those numbers down, and you still get millions of places where life could exist. So
odds are good,
I'd say. The odds are good that there's life out there, I would say, whether or not they're trying to make contact with us or have that technological ability at the moment. Open question.
One final question. Where is this telescope going to be built?
Here? Oh, I get asked this a lot right now. So Project Minerva right now, we're evaluating four sites that are competing for our location. I can tell you they're all in the Northern Hemisphere. They're all mountaintops. They're all high, dry, dark, the things that we want, calm air, the things that are really useful for our scientific observations. Beyond that, we will probably be making our final decision here by September. And we anticipate UM's telescope being moved to whichever location we choose sometime next summer.
I have been speaking with Nate McCready, who's an associate professor of astrophysics at the University of Montana, and he is one of the principal investigators in Project Minerva, which is a project to explore the existence of exoplanets and what those exoplanets might play host to. And then we certainly look forward to the outcome of this research, Dr. McCready. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Sally.
And in tonight's weather forecast, for west of the Continental Divide, tonight expect clear skies with lows in the upper 40s to mid-50s. Tomorrow calls for mostly sunny skies with highs in the upper 80s to mid-90s. For central Montana, tonight will be mostly clear with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms with lows in the upper 50s. Tomorrow look for sunny skies. Highs will be in the upper 80 to 90 degrees. And for southwest Montana, tonight expect mostly clear skies with lows in the upper 50s. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon. Highs will be in the upper 80s. To 95 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Sterling Holy White Mountain.
Given the Chicago Blackhawks Stanley Cup victory last month, I think it would be good to talk for a few minutes about a few of the more prominent sports teams in this country that use American Indian-related names and logos. The Chicago Blackhawks were established in 1926, making them one of the first six American teams to become part of the then-young National Hockey League. The franchise was established by Frederick McLaughlin, who served in World War I in the 333rd Machine Gun Battalion of the 86th Infantry Division, a division more commonly known as the Blackhawk Division. McLaughlin named his fledgling NHL team in honor of the division, only indirectly, I assume, giving the team a name that refers to the Sauk tribal leader who led his people, in addition to members of the Meskwaki and Kickapoo tribes, in a conflict against the United States in 1832 in a war known simply today as the Blackhawk War. Blackhawk's reason for fighting the U.S.? A treaty from 1804, signed unwittingly by Quashaquame, a Sauk leader, that ceded large portions of Sauk land in western Illinois and northeastern Missouri. From a Sauk perspective, the treaty was invalid, as Quashaquame and the others who signed the treaty had not been authorized by their respective tribal councils to do so. While I am sure McLaughlin found a sense of honor, or even respect, as so many Americans claim when using American Indian tribal names for various purposes, and while he may have known his infantry division was named after a Sauk leader, I would bet something, not money, because who has money these days, that McLaughlin knew little to nothing about the history behind the name, or that he considered the strange irony of naming a military division after a defeated American Indian military leader. And I deeply doubt he considered that, from a Sauk perspective, the use of one of their great leaders' names for a sports team name might be somewhat offensive, and that it might result in a degradation of meaning. It's not all that dissimilar, is it not, to a team some 100 years from now calling themselves the Martin Luther King Juniors, or perhaps the Che Guevaras, makes more sense as an analogy. Meanwhile, in the great state of North Dakota, several decades' controversy over the University of North Dakota's logo and team name seems to have come to a close. The team, formerly known as the Fighting Sioux's original logo, an Indian head logo in the tradition of the Indian head nickel minted from 1913 to 1938, was designed by a student of Ojibwe descent, which, according to proponents of the team, keeping the logo gives the logo validity. However, from one American Indian's perspective, such an argument continues the long-standing tradition of, to put it simply, taking one Indian's actions or thoughts to stand for the actions of all Indians, a move as ignorant as assuming the actions and thoughts of one white American stand for the actions of all white Americans, a move which, unfortunately, is not all that uncommon in either case. The official legal and bureaucratic conflict over UND's team name began in 1999 when a bill was introduced in the North Dakota House of Representatives that would have eliminated the nickname. The next attempt came in 2000 when 21 Indian-related programs, departments, and organizations at UND signed a statement asking for the end of the nickname. In 2005, the NCAA made the decision to sanction any schools using tribal logos and/or nicknames deemed hostile or offensive by the NCAA. The sanctions would deny any such team the right to use their logos or names in postseason play and also bar them from hosting any postseason championships. While there have been numerous responses in the following years to these potential sanctions, the most interesting and baffling for me has been that of the North Dakota Senate in the spring of 2011, which approved legislation ordering UND to retain the nickname and logo, a bill which was signed by the governor but later repealed in a special session the following fall. Less than a year later came a petition signed by over 17,000 state residents demanding the issue go to vote, which it finally did, with 67% of those who voted choosing to retire the name. As today, the team does not have a name other than UND, and the school will not be deciding on a new name for another few years. Some have come up with a way of protesting this situation and are making a shirt being sold in Fargo, the school's location, bearing the phrase, "Don't call me UND, I'm a Sioux." As for history, the nickname itself was officially adopted in 1930, with the students writing into the UND newspaper saying the choice was a good one, being that the Sioux people were warlike and of fine physique and bearing, and that the name easily rhymed for purposes of yells and songs. It's worth considering, I think, that at the same time the nickname was approved, there had to be any number of Sioux in the Dakotas for whom the dissolution of the Great Sioux Reservation was fresh on their minds, a dissolution that occurred only 41 years earlier via an act of Congress undertaken with no input from the Sioux themselves. Strangest of all, though, is that of the position of the NFL football team located in our nation's capital. The name, which originated in 1933 with the team's first owner, George Preston Marshall, a man who was once called the NFL's leading bigot and who was also a proponent of segregation, which is another way of saying I believe we can assume he was not overly concerned with the thoughts and feelings of minority groups in the U.S. Current team owner Dan Snyder has stated that the team's name will never change, and NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell has said the name is a unifying force that stands for strength, courage, pride, and respect. I would ask you to explain to me how it is that a racial slur can stand for such things, but I believe our time is better spent elsewhere. Recently, a letter was written by 10 congressmen to the organization asking for the team to change its name and also stating that the R word is no different than using the N word. Snyder has not responded to this letter. As for responses from former players, Joe Theismann has said he was proud to have played for the team and that he did it to honor Native people, a statement which sounds very pretty at first, but stops making sense soon after. Jeff Bostic, on the other hand, has made it clear on no uncertain terms he thinks the name has no negative connotations. I would love to have the opportunity to ask both of these men what it is they know about the American Indian experience, or even American Indian history for that matter. I would also ask them what they think about the following statement from Suzanne Harjo, president of the Morningstar Institute, a national indigenous rights organization. I would also ask them what they think about the following statement from Suzanne Harjo, president of the Morningstar Institute, a national indigenous rights organization. I would ask them what they think when she says, "For most Native Americans, there's no more offensive name in English. That non-Native folks think they get to measure or decide what offends us is adding insult to injury." There is, of course, one more prominent sports team mascot I have not talked about today, and which is surely one worth considering, but I will leave it to those of you listening in and your respective imaginations to consider the image the Cleveland Indians, night after night for 162 games each year, display on their hats. I will leave it to you to consider whether or not such an image associated with any other group of people in this country would be acceptable, and if not, then why, in this case, it is. I'm Sterling Holywhite Mountain. Thank you for listening.
Sterling Holy White Mountain is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.